A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's asking about something I think a lot of men feel, but don't always name. Men tying their self-worth to their income, their job title, their financial standing. What happens when that equation breaks down? Unemployment, or a spouse who out-earns them? And the bigger question, how do you decouple who you are from what you earn? This one hits close to home for a lot of people.
It really does. And the research on this is actually pretty stark. There was a study out of the University of Sheffield a few years back that found men's self-esteem is significantly more tied to their income than women's, and the effect isn't small. We're talking about a correlation that shows up across income brackets, across age groups, across countries. It's one of those findings where you read it and think, well, that explains a lot.
It explains everything from midlife crises to why guys buy sports cars they can't afford. But I want to push on the why before we get into the effects. Is this biological? Some unholy mix of both?
It's almost entirely cultural, but that doesn't make it less real. If you go back far enough, the provider role had a material basis. In agrarian societies, physical labor was a real constraint, and there was a division of labor that made practical sense. But the psychological weight of it, the idea that a man's value is his paycheck, that's a much more recent construction. It really solidifies in the Industrial Revolution, when work leaves the home and becomes this separate sphere. Suddenly, you've got this clean split. Men go out and earn, women manage the domestic space, and that arrangement gets moralized.
Moralized is the right word. It's not just, this is how we do things. It becomes, this is what a good man does. And once you attach morality to a paycheck, you've created a trap that snaps shut the moment the paycheck disappears.
And the research backs this up in really troubling ways. There's a well-known study from the Journal of Health and Social Behavior that found unemployment increases psychological distress far more for men than for women, even when controlling for financial strain. It's not just about the money running out, it's about identity collapse. The distress persists even in households where a spouse's income keeps them financially stable.
It's not, I can't pay the bills. It's, I'm not a man. That's a much deeper wound.
And that brings us to one of the most disturbing patterns in this research, the link between male unemployment and suicide. The numbers are genuinely alarming. A study published in The Lancet Psychiatry found that unemployment is associated with a 2 to 3 times higher risk of suicide in men compared to employed men. During the 2008 recession, for every 1% increase in unemployment, the male suicide rate rose by about 1.4%. These are not abstract statistics. These are real patterns of men reaching a point where losing their economic role feels like losing their reason to exist.
I think what's insidious about this is that it's not just about major job loss. It's the constant low-grade comparison. You go to a dinner party, someone asks what you do, and you know that answer is being weighed. If you say, I'm between jobs, or you're in a field that doesn't command respect, you can feel the room recalculating.
The status anxiety piece. And it's not imaginary. There's real social penalty here. Men who are unemployed or underemployed report losing friends, losing social standing, being treated differently by family members. It's not all in their heads.
Let's talk about the other side of this. The spouse who out-earns. Because I think this is where a lot of the cultural programming really shows itself, even in men who think of themselves as progressive.
Oh, this is a fascinating area. There was a big study out of the University of Chicago, Booth School of Business, that looked at marriage outcomes when women earn more than their husbands. The findings were, frankly, depressing. Marriages where the wife out-earns the husband are 50% more likely to end in divorce.
That's not a rounding error.
No, it's not. And here's the kicker. It's not just divorce rates. The same research found that when wives earn more, husbands report lower life satisfaction, and the couple is more likely to misreport their incomes. The husband inflates his, the wife deflates hers, when surveyed. People are literally lying about who earns what to make the dynamic feel more traditional.
That's wild. They're not just unhappy about it. They're rewriting the numbers to make the unhappiness go away. It's like financial gaslighting, but self-inflicted.
There's a related study from the American Sociological Review that found men who are economically dependent on their wives are actually more likely to cheat. Not less, more. The theory is that infidelity becomes a way to reassert masculinity when the traditional provider role is threatened. It's a deeply unhealthy coping mechanism, but it makes psychological sense when you understand how central this identity is.
The man whose wife out earns him is statistically more likely to be unhappy, more likely to divorce, more likely to cheat, and more likely to lie about his income on surveys. This is not a flattering portrait of the modern male.
It's really not. But I think it's important to name the pattern before we can talk about fixing it. And I should say, there's some nuance here. More recent research, including a study from the Pew Research Center, suggests these effects are smaller among younger couples. Millennials and Gen Z seem to be somewhat less hung up on the male breadwinner norm. But somewhat less is not gone. The gap is shrinking, but it's still there.
Which suggests this is learned, and if it's learned, it can be unlearned. But I want to push back on something. Sometimes when people talk about men needing to decouple self-worth from income, it sounds like they're saying, just stop caring about money. And I don't think that's realistic or even desirable. Providing for your family is a good thing. Ambition is a good thing. The problem isn't caring about your work. It's making it the whole foundation of who you are.
That's a crucial distinction. The goal isn't to make men indifferent to their careers. It's to build a broader foundation for identity so that if one pillar collapses, the whole structure doesn't come down. Think of it like a diversified portfolio. If your entire sense of self is invested in one stock, your job title, you're one layoff away from bankruptcy.
And I think for a lot of men, they don't even realize how concentrated their identity portfolio is until the layoff happens. You spend 20 years being the guy who does X, and then X is gone, and you look in the mirror and don't know who's looking back.
There's a term for this in psychology, identity foreclosure. It's when someone commits to an identity, usually one handed to them by their culture or family, without exploring alternatives. A lot of men foreclose on provider and professional very early, and they never go back and ask, is this actually who I want to be, or is this just the script I was handed?
So you're basically signing a mortgage on a self you never inspected.
And the foreclosure happens so early that by the time the cracks show, you've got decades of sunk cost. Walking away from that identity feels like admitting the whole thing was a mistake.
Which brings us to the question of how you actually decouple. And I think step one is just naming the problem. A lot of men walk around with this vague sense of inadequacy, and they don't even know it's coming from the provider script. They just feel like they're failing, and they can't articulate why.
Naming it is huge, and I think step two is deliberately building those other pillars of identity before you need them. Don't wait for the crisis. If your only identity is your job, start investing in something else now. A hobby that has nothing to do with your career, a community role, a skill you're learning purely for the joy of it, something where failure doesn't feel existential.
I think that's harder than it sounds for a lot of men, because even their hobbies get turned into side hustles. You pick up woodworking, and within 6 months, someone's asking if you sell your stuff on Etsy. We can't seem to let anything just be play.
That's such a good point. The hustle culture has colonized leisure. Everything has to be monetizable or it's not worth doing. And that's exactly the wrong instinct if you're trying to build an identity that's independent of economic output.
It's like the Protestant work ethic on steroids. Not only must you work hard, you must also make your rest productive. Your relaxation should generate income. Your downtime should build your brand. It's exhausting just describing it.
It's counterproductive. The research on psychological well-being is pretty clear. Activities done for their own sake, what psychologists call intrinsic motivation, are far more protective against depression and anxiety than activities done for external rewards. If you turn every hobby into a job, you've just added another boss to your life.
One piece of advice is, have something you're bad at and keep being bad at it.
I love that. The deliberate cultivation of incompetence as a spiritual practice.
I'm serious, though. There's something liberating about doing something where nobody's evaluating you, nobody's paying you, and the stakes are zero. It reminds you that you exist outside of your output.
No, I completely agree. And I think there's another piece here that doesn't get talked about enough, male friendship. One of the things that happens when men tie their entire identity to work and family is they let their friendships atrophy. Then when the job goes or the marriage gets rocky, they've got no support network. The loneliness is crushing.
This is a well-documented thing, right? Men in middle age have fewer close friends than any other demographic?
Yeah, there was a big study from the Survey Center on American Life that found 15% of men report having zero close friends, up from 3% in the 1990s. And the number of men who say they have at least six close friends has been cut in half. It's a friendship recession, and it hits men hardest exactly when they're most vulnerable to career and identity disruption.
15% with zero close friends. That's one in seven guys walking around with nobody to call when things fall apart. And it's not like they don't want friends. They just don't maintain them. Work eats everything.
This is where the provider identity becomes a double trap. You pour everything into your career because that's what a good man does. Your friendships wither because you're too busy. Then your career stumbles and you've got no one to help you process it. So you're isolated, ashamed, and convinced you're a failure, with no countervailing voice to tell you otherwise.
It's the perfect storm. And I think we need to talk about shame directly here, because shame is the engine that drives a lot of this. Unemployment isn't just stressful, it's shameful. Being out-earned by your wife isn't just uncomfortable, it's shameful. And shame thrives in silence.
Shame researcher Brené Brown talks about this. Shame needs three things to grow: secrecy, silence, and judgment. And men are particularly bad at breaking those conditions because we're socialized not to talk about feelings, especially feelings of inadequacy. So the shame just compounds.
Every guy who's been laid off feels this. Every guy whose wife got the big promotion feels some version of this. But nobody says it out loud, so everybody thinks they're the only one.
There's actually some interesting research on this from the men's mental health space. Peer support groups for men, where guys just sit in a room and talk honestly about what's going on, have shown really promising results. But the uptake is low because the very men who need it most are the ones least likely to walk through the door.
Because walking through the door is an admission that you need help, which is itself a violation of the masculine script. The script that tells you you're supposed to be self-sufficient, unflappable, the rock. Asking for help means you failed at being the rock.
That's the script that kills people. When you look at suicide prevention, one of the biggest predictors of whether a man in crisis will seek help is whether he has a single person he feels safe being vulnerable with. Not a therapist, just one person.
Practically, if you're a guy listening to this and you're feeling this weight, whether it's unemployment or your spouse out-earning you, or just this grinding sense that your worth is tied to a number on a paycheck, what's the first step? What do you actually do on Monday morning?
I think step one is the naming exercise. Actually write down, I believe my worth as a person is tied to my income. Look at it on paper. Ask yourself if you'd say that to a friend. Because most men hold this belief implicitly, but would never articulate it, and the act of articulating it often reveals how absurd it is.
It's like saying, I believe human value is denominated in dollars, which, when you say it out loud, sounds monstrous. But that's the logic you're living under if you haven't examined it.
Step two, I'd say, is the diversification we talked about. Pick one thing this week that has nothing to do with your career or your income and invest time in it. Not to get good at it, not to monetize it, just because it interests you. Relearn what it feels like to do something for its own sake.
Step three, call a friend. Not text, call. Have an actual conversation. If you don't have a friend you can call, that's a sign you need to rebuild that muscle. A running club, a book group, a volunteer organization. Something where you show up regularly and see the same faces.
There's actually evidence that regular in-person social contact is one of the strongest protective factors against depression in men. Stronger than income, stronger than job status. The quality of your relationships is a better predictor of mental health than the size of your paycheck. But our culture tells us the opposite.
Because relationships don't show up on a W-2. You can't put good friend on a loan application, so we discount it.
And I think step four, and this is the harder one, is to examine the story you're telling yourself about what it means to be a man. Where did you learn that your worth equals your income? Was it your father? The culture at large? Because until you identify where the script came from, it's very hard to rewrite it.
I think for a lot of guys, it was their fathers. Even if their fathers never said it explicitly. You watch your dad come home from work, and you see how he carries himself when the job is going well versus when it's not. You absorb the lesson without anyone ever stating it.
That's the intergenerational piece. Men who grew up with fathers who were deeply defined by their careers often inherit that blueprint, even if the economic landscape has completely changed. Your dad worked at one company for 30 years and got a pension. You're navigating the gig economy and mass layoffs. The old script doesn't work anymore, but nobody gave you a new one.
That's a really important point. The economic conditions that made the male breadwinner model viable for a lot of families just don't exist anymore. Real wages have been stagnant for decades. Dual income households are the norm, not the exception. The idea that a man should be the sole provider is a relic of an economy that no longer exists, but the psychological expectation persists.
That mismatch between economic reality and cultural expectation is a huge source of distress. Men are measuring themselves against a standard that was built for a different world, and then feeling like failures when they can't meet it. It's like trying to run a modern operating system on hardware from 1975 and wondering why it keeps crashing.
Let's talk about the spouse out-earning scenario specifically, because I think there's a nuance here that gets missed. It's not just about ego. For some men, it's about feeling unnecessary. If she doesn't need your income, what does she need you for? And that's a terrifying question if your whole model of relationships is built on provision.
That's such a crucial insight. A lot of men have what psychologists call a utility model of love, the idea that they're loved because of what they provide, not who they are. And if the provision becomes redundant, the love feels conditional. That's not necessarily what their spouse is communicating, but it's what they feel.
The spouse might be thinking, great, we have more money, this is wonderful. Meanwhile, he's quietly spiraling because his entire function in the relationship just got outsourced to her paycheck.
There's a really good book on this. I think it's The Second Shift, Adjacent Research, that found when wives out-earn husbands, the husbands often compensate by doing less housework, not more. Which seems counterintuitive. You'd think if she's earning more, he'd pick up more at home. But the dynamic is actually the opposite. Men who feel their masculinity is threatened by their wife's income often withdraw from domestic labor as a way to reassert traditional gender roles.
Not only is he not providing financially, he's also not helping around the house, which makes the marriage worse. It's a self-destructive spiral.
It really is. And the marriages that navigate this successfully tend to have something in common. The couple has explicitly talked about it. They've named the dynamic. They've rejected the script together. The husband has done the work to find his identity outside of his paycheck, and the wife has been patient with that process.
Which requires a level of emotional literacy that a lot of men just haven't been taught. You're asking a guy who's never been encouraged to talk about his feelings, to have a nuanced conversation about his insecurities around his wife's salary. That's graduate-level relationship work for someone who's still in remedial emotions.
This is where I think therapy, or at minimum, some kind of structured self-reflection, becomes really important. Not because therapy is a magic fix, but because it gives you a space to practice the emotional vocabulary you never developed. It's like going to the gym for a muscle you've never used.
I want to circle back to something you mentioned earlier, the intergenerational piece. Because I think one of the most powerful things a man can do is model something different for his own kids. If you've got sons, they're watching how you handle this. They're absorbing your anxiety about money and status, or they're absorbing your security in a broader identity. You get to choose which one.
That's beautifully put. And it's not just about sons. Daughters are watching too. They're learning what to expect from men, what a healthy male identity looks like. If they see Dad defining himself entirely by his job, they internalize that as normal.
Breaking the cycle isn't just good for you. It's a gift to the next generation. And I think that's a framing that might actually resonate with men who are otherwise resistant to this kind of introspection. You're not doing it for yourself. You're doing it so your son doesn't have to carry the same weight.
I'd add, so your son knows that it's okay to struggle. One of the most damaging parts of the provider script is that it leaves no room for failure. If your worth is your income, then any dip in income is a dip in worth. That's an unbearable way to live. Modeling resilience, showing your kids that you could lose a job and still be okay, still be loved, still be a whole person, that's a profound gift.
All right, let's get practical for a minute. Someone listening to this is unemployed right now. He's in it. The identity collapse is happening. What does he do today?
First, recognize that the psychological distress you're feeling is normal. It's not a sign that you're weak or broken. It's a predictable response to losing a major source of identity. The research says this is what happens to most men in this situation. You're not uniquely failing.
Normalizing the feeling is underrated. Just knowing this is what humans do when this happens takes some of the shame out of it.
Second, maintain structure. One of the things that makes unemployment so destabilizing is the loss of routine. Get up at the same time every day. Have a schedule. It doesn't have to be a job search schedule. It can include exercise, learning, volunteering, but the structure itself is protective.
Structure as scaffolding. You're rebuilding your days while you rebuild your identity.
Third, separate your job search from your sense of self. This is hard, but crucial. You are not your applications. You are not the rejections. You are a person looking for work. The looking is an activity, not an identity.
Fourth, I'd say, tell someone how you're actually doing, not fine or hanging in there. The real answer, pick one person and be honest. The shame loses power when it's spoken.
There's a concept in psychology called emotional disclosure, the act of putting feelings into words. Studies show it has measurable benefits for mental and even physical health. Just the act of articulating, "I feel worthless because I don't have a job," to another human being reduces the intensity of that feeling.
It's like diffusing a bomb. You name the wire, cut it, and suddenly the whole thing is less volatile.
I think the final piece, and this applies whether you're unemployed, out-earned, or just feeling the weight of the provider expectation, is to consciously develop a philosophy of what makes a life meaningful that goes beyond economic output. This sounds abstract, but it's actually very concrete. What do you want people to say about you at your funeral? Nobody's eulogy says he was a consistent top performer who exceeded his quarterly targets.
They talk about whether you were kind, whether you showed up for people, whether you made them laugh. The things that actually matter have nothing to do with your W-2.
Yet we spend decades optimizing for the thing nobody will remember. It's a massive misallocation of attention.
The philosopher in me wants to say this goes back to the ancient distinction between having and being. You can have a job, have money, have a title, but those are possessions, not identity. Who you are is something else entirely. And we've confused the two for so long that we've forgotten there's a difference.
There's actually some fascinating work on this from positive psychology. Martin Seligman's well-being theory identifies 5 pillars of flourishing: positive emotion, engagement, relationships, meaning, and accomplishment. Notice that only one of those, accomplishment, has anything to do with career achievement. And even that isn't limited to paid work. Accomplishment can come from mastering a skill, raising children, contributing to your community.
The guy who ties his entire well-being to his paycheck is operating on 1/5 of the available pillars. 4/5 of the structure is just sitting there unused.
And that's why the crash is so hard when the one pillar fails. There's nothing else holding you up.
I want to address something that I think gets glossed over in these conversations. There's sometimes a subtext, especially in more progressive spaces, that caring about your income or your career at all is somehow regressive or toxic. And I think that's wrong. Ambition is not the problem. Wanting to provide for your family is not the problem. The problem is making it the whole story.
I completely agree. The goal isn't to stop caring about your work, it's to stop needing your work to tell you who you are. You can be deeply invested in your career and still have a rich identity outside of it. Those things aren't in tension. They're complementary.
It's the difference between I am a provider and providing is one of the things I do. One is an identity. The other is an activity. The activity can change without destroying you.
I think for a lot of men, making that shift requires a period of intentional discomfort. You have to sit with the question, who am I without my job, and not immediately reach for an answer. Let the question be uncomfortable. Let it be unanswered for a while. That's where the growth happens.
That's very Buddhist of you. Sit with the void.
I mean, there's a reason contemplative traditions have been talking about detachment for thousands of years. They're not saying, don't care about anything. They're saying, don't let your peace depend on things you can lose.
You can lose a job, you can lose a title, you can lose a salary. Those are all contingent. If your self-worth is contingent on contingent things, you're building a house on sand.
To bring this back to the prompt's core question, how do men decouple self-worth from income and occupation? I think the answer has layers. Layer 1 is awareness, recognizing the script you've been handed and naming it. Layer 2 is diversification, building identity in multiple domains so no single failure is catastrophic. Layer 3 is connection, maintaining friendships and relationships that remind you that you're valued for who you are, not what you earn. And layer 4 is philosophy, developing a conscious understanding of what makes a life meaningful that goes beyond economic output.
That's a solid framework. And I'd add layer 5, which is practice. You have to actually live this, not just think about it. That means making choices that reflect your broader values, even when they cost you money or status. Turning down the promotion that would eat your family time. Keeping the hobby that doesn't pay. Calling the friend even when you're busy. The practice is what makes the philosophy real.
The practice is everything. It's easy to agree with this intellectually and then go right back to checking your portfolio and refreshing LinkedIn. The practice is the hard part.
I think for the guys listening who are in the thick of it, unemployed or struggling with a spouse's success, or just feeling the weight of not measuring up, the most important thing we can say is you're not broken. You're responding to a broken script. And scripts can be rewritten.
It takes time, and it's uncomfortable, and you'll probably need help. But it's possible, and the men I know who've done this work are not less ambitious or less successful. If anything, they're more effective because they're not operating from a place of desperate validation seeking. They're doing good work because they want to, not because they need it to feel whole.
Desperate validation seeking is a terrible business strategy anyway. People can smell it.
They absolutely can. And it repels the very opportunities you're trying to attract. Confidence that comes from a stable sense of self is magnetic. Neediness is not.
Paradoxically, caring less about your income as a source of identity might actually make you more successful. But that can't be the reason you do it, or you're right back in the trap.
That's the koan at the center of this whole thing. You have to let go. Not let go as a strategy to get ahead. Let go because it's actually true that your worth isn't your income. And once you believe that, the whole game changes.
All right. I think we've covered this from a lot of angles. Let's land the plane.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
Early Islamic cartographers in the 9th century developed remarkably accurate world maps using celestial navigation and traveler accounts. But their work inadvertently created a centuries-long misconception that the Pacific island nation of Tuvalu was actually a floating mountain range that migrated seasonally, a cartographic error so persistent it appeared in Persian atlases well into the early Renaissance.
A floating mountain range that migrates seasonally. That's not a map error. That's a fantasy novel premise.
I want to read that book.
This has been my Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer Hilbert Flumingtop for keeping the show running, and thanks to all of you for listening. If you got something out of this episode, share it with someone who might need to hear it. You probably know a guy. Find us at myweirdprompts.com.
See you next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.